This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
The Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre presents Well, Well, Well on Joy, the show that's all about sex, health and well-being.
Welcome to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9, presented to you every week by VAC, the Victorian AIDS Council, as we talk about health and well-being in our gender, sex, and sexually diverse community. I'm John, joined this week by my co-host Jessie. How are you doing, Jessie?
I'm really good, thanks, John. Second week in a row. I've actually told quite a few of my friends to listen to this as well, so hopefully we've got some more listeners coming in tonight.
Yeah, well, hopefully so, and welcome if you are joining us for the first time today. On tonight's show, we're fortunate to be joined by Dr. Adam Bourne, a researcher on some of our favorite topics, drug use, chemsex, and how they affect our health and well-being. There will be a lot of very interesting discussion tonight, and we'd love for you to take part. Jessie, how can our listeners get in touch with us?
Well, as there are a plethora of ways, as per usual, you can email us here at onair@joy.org.au, or you can text into 0427-JOY-949, which is 0427-569-949, and it reaches us directly in the studios. We could always read out a message, or you can join in the discussion that way and ask some extra questions for our very special guests.
Yay, fantastic. Well, thanks again for joining us. We'll return shortly with Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. And we're welcoming you back. Sorry about that brief moment, guys.
I'm still learning the boards here.
Indeed. Oh, so patience, I think part of that was my fault. But anyway, we are joined in the studio tonight by a special guest visiting us from London, Dr. Adam Bourne. Welcome. How are you today?
I am very well, Jesse. It's very nice to be here.
Good, good. Yeah, I was talking about you earlier today. I'm saying that, you know, Adam Bourne's on our show and I called you Jason Bourne. Do you get that a lot?
I do get it a lot. Usually at passport control, whenever I hand my passport over,
you must be
they
so
say,
sick
oh,
of that.
You're Jason's brother?
And yeah. Oh my goodness, I wish. Never heard that one before. I can imagine. So Dr. Adam Bourne is an assistant professor from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, focusing on drug use in the LGBTI community. So, Adam, your research focuses a lot on drug use amongst gay and bisexual men. Can you give us a rundown of what issues you look into and why?
I certainly can, yeah. So I work in a specialist research group at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, which is a very convoluted way of saying a university that focuses on public health. And I work within a specialist centre that all the research we do really is about gay and bisexual men, about other members of the LGBT community.
Awesome.
And a lot of my work is I specialise in understanding risk behaviours. So the things that we do that are risky in the bedroom, in the back room, in the dark room, in the club, the drugs we take, the alcohol we drink, the kind of sex that we have. And I work a lot with equivalents of the Victorian AIDS Council back home in London, but also actually quite a number of organisations in sub-Saharan Africa and in Southern Asia, helping them to understand the patterns of behaviour among LGBT people. But obviously I have a specific interest in drug and alcohol use.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing because we hear a lot about drug and alcohol use among the LGBTI community. What are the rates of drug use? Why should we care?
Well, we should care because it's always higher among this community. Pretty much every survey that's ever been conducted on this population anywhere in the world, and that's especially true of here in Australia, you see that gay men, that LGBT people are more likely to drink alcohol on a regular basis. They're more likely to have a problematic relationship with alcohol. And they're more likely to use a range of illicit drugs, particularly stimulant drugs. So cocaine, ecstasy, methamphetamine, speed. Much more likely to utilise those drugs. Data we have in the UK says that gay men are 4 times more likely to use an illicit drug than the general population, and they're 7 times more likely to use a stimulant drug. Like, these are really, really, really stark differences between us and the heterosexual population.
Is there a particular age group that is obviously higher.
It is. It's pretty varied, and it depends a lot on the drug itself, to be honest.
Yeah.
So you tend to see use of drugs like crystal methamphetamine. Ice, I think it's most.
Yeah.
So we refer to it more in the UK as crystal, but I think here colloquially is called ice, isn't it?
Yeah.
So ice for us is typically among slightly older men in their middle age,
okay,
perhaps into their 40s. It's a much more expensive drug in the UK than other ones that are popular. And so it's often the case that it's only older guys have a bit more disposable income, mm-hmm, and can afford to pay for it.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the other drugs, really, really varied. It's not really easy to distinguish a pattern,
yeah,
from the very young 16, 17-year-old guys right up to those in their 60s and 70s. It's really, really broad pattern.
Yeah.
That's strange. Now, are the rates, are they universal across LGBTI people, or, you know, it's quite a broad community? Are they different rates for everybody?
Yeah, I mean, we're as different as we are similar as a population. We share in common an attraction, LGBs sharing in common an attraction to someone of the same gender.
Mm.
Beyond that point, there's lots of things about us that are different, and drug use is a good example of that. And you certainly see... you see higher rates of alcohol use among lesbian and bisexual women. Much higher use of alcohol among lesbian women compared to their heterosexual counterparts. Gay men are much more likely to utilize methamphetamine than lesbians. It's not a drug you observe as often among lesbian and bisexual women.
Yeah.
Certainly in the UK context, and I'm pretty sure the same is true here in Australia as well. And I was... there's some really interesting work looking at not only about our, you know, our age and our and, you know, if we're lesbian or gay, but also kind of subcultural identities. How we describe ourselves? Are we a bear?
Like within the community.
Within the community. Yeah. Like, okay, are you a twink? Are you a bear? Mm-hmm. Are you an otter?
Really?
And actually, you see that there are differences in how people use drugs according to how they describe themselves as well.
Yeah.
So men who describe themselves as twinks are more likely to smoke. They're more likely to use alcohol, yeah, regularly, and they're actually more likely to use a range of illicit drugs compared,
yeah,
to guys who describe themselves as a cub or describe themselves as a bear. And that's got a lot to do with the kind of social settings that they kind of hang out in.
Yeah, I guess the next question, a little bit obvious, is what makes drug and alcohol use amongst the LGBTI population so much higher?
I mean, there are a couple of explanations that have been put forward, and none of them are perfect. The one that links most closely to the previous question really is this, the kind of idea that, you know, as a community of people, we don't have the same opportunities to interact with other LGBT people on a daily basis. There's not that many of us as a proportion of the population. Like, you're not as likely to meet another LGBT person walking down the street, in the coffee shop, in the gym, in the workplace. And so we have to hang out together in physical locations. We go to bars and we go to clubs where you can meet other people, to make friends, to find a sexual partner, to find a boyfriend or a girlfriend.
Mm.
And all those kinds of those bars and clubs, which are a really central part of our lives or of the gay communities, they serve alcohol.
Yeah.
And drugs are often quite readily available in those settings. And so is it perhaps a virtue of the way we live and the way we interact with one another that means we're just exposed to alcohol and drugs on a bit more of a regular basis?
Yeah.
Another explanation that is often used is really, we face a whole load of other stresses in our life compared to the heterosexual population. We are
indeed
a minority group. We are marginalized within society, and that's still the case now, despite a lot of progression.
Yeah.
It's still the case that we're a minority group. And we have to deal with stigma and discrimination. We have to deal with that continuing sense that we are an other. We're not quite fitting within the norms that society have set for us. And that creates a stress that we feel, maybe subconsciously, maybe we're not always aware of it, but it creates a stress that we feel. And perhaps some people then turn to alcohol and drugs to help escape from those kinds of worries, those concerns, those stresses, to escape from the kind of stigma that they're experiencing from other people. And so alcohol and drugs is used to kind of medicate in that respect. And so those are kind of the two main hypotheses put forward to why we see this really stark difference.
Okay, we'll get back to more of this in just a little bit. First, some lovely community service announcements, but you're listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
For over 25 years, the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives have been collecting and preserving Australia's queer history. A not-for-profit organisation, the Archives rely on your support through membership, financial and queer memorabilia donations. To find out more, email algarchives@hotmail.com or web search the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives.
You're back with Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9, where we're talking with Dr. Adam Bourne about drug use among LGBTI people. So, Adam, we were just talking about how rates of drug and alcohol use are significantly higher for LGBTI people, and about why that is. You put forward, I think it was minority stress theory was one of them.
That's right, yep.
Always fascinating. But one of the other things we like to look at is where people are using drugs. So I know I've heard you speaking earlier today about gay bars and how we meet people there, but now we've had this whole new paradigm shift where we have gay apps and websites and all these different things. Can you talk about the relationship with that and how that affects drug use and alcohol consumption?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think apps, Grindr, Scruff, Hornet, these kinds of things, particularly for gay men, they allow access to drugs in a way that's very different to how it was before. Before, if you were in a, you know, you go to a club and you kind of need to know who's the person to speak to, who's the guy to score them from. You need to know a little bit about the language, about how you make that kind of approach.
So pardon my ignorance here. Are we saying that the guys are using these hookup apps to score or pick up or deal?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean,
that's actually news to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I knew it was kind of, you know, if it was amongst people you knew and it was just kind of like a platform to chat. Mm. I didn't know it was kind of a bit more widespread than that.
I think if you know the language to look for on the apps.
Of course, yes. You know, when it comes to the language, we did.
I mean, you kind of just need to be attentive to the
or
the
even
way
a specific emoji, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. The ways in which guys are describing what they're looking for on their profile. The name they give to their profile, they're often very coded messages about I've got drugs, I'm looking to sell. I'm looking to score some drugs. I'm hosting a party where guys are using drugs. If people are interested to come along. It's very sophisticated, actually, how people have come to use these technologies.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's exclusive to gay and bisexual men. I think there's some really interesting evidence from other populations of people who use drugs, seeing how they're also kind of using WhatsApp and other technologies to do the same kind of thing. Mm. It's not surprising, right? I mean, this technology makes it much more immediate.
Yeah.
It does make the process easier. You don't have to have that dark, hushed conversation down an alleyway with this guy you're not really sure about anymore.
Exactly.
It facilitates a different kind of contact.
Yeah. I was actually wondering, because you were saying, you know, a place where you'd meet up is usually a nightclub or a bar. I wonder if, like, what about something like a gay gym or like a gay cafe? You know, I wonder if that would be seen as discriminatory or something, but essentially that's kind of like, that's a good space to meet people.
Mm.
But you don't really see gay cafes or gay gyms around, right?
No, and I think that was something you had talked about earlier, is that these physical social spaces are kind of disappearing because it's much easier for people to engage in a digital space where they don't have that fear and inhibition about walking up to it. Am I missing?
No, you're absolutely right. Okay. I mean, in London, we're seeing, you know, really wide scale shutdown of the gay scene. Don't get me wrong, we still have a massive number of gay bars and clubs.
Yeah.
But it is a real shadow of what it was 10 years ago. Lots of our very large venues closing down. Mm. And partly that's because of changes in, you know, and how they're legislated and councils not always as friendly towards them, but a lot of it is people aren't going as often as they used to. And it's not, you know, I think we, you know, there is a clear, we can draw a clear line with how the rise of apps at the same time, they mean you don't have to go out to a bar or club in the same way if what you're looking for is to meet another person, either for friendship, for sex, or even for a relationship. They're not entirely sexual sites. I mean, people use them for a variety of purposes.
Yeah, this is fair. Do you think there's any impact from, I suppose you would call it internalized homophobia, just this sense of shame that is hypothesized that we all have about our sexuality or our gender identity. Does that play into people not going into these spaces or play into people engaging or looking for drugs on these apps?
I think there is some good evidence showing that people who are less comfortable with their sexual identity, people who are less out to, you know, their friends and family about their sexual identity, are much more likely to utilize gay apps. And you can understand why, right? Because it's much easier to turn on a phone in the privacy of your own home and try to identify a potential sexual partner or someone to go and have a drink with than that pretty scary experience the first time you walk into a gay bar and everyone turns to look at you.
Or even slightly reducing the like fear of rejection, you know? Yeah. It's easier to hide behind your phone screen or something like that because it's hard. No one likes getting rejected.
Absolutely. But I mean, I think, you know, we have to think about the consequences of that. I mean, there is some really great things about having a gay community physical space where we meet and where we interact, and it provides that sense, provides a greater sense of social cohesion and a sense of community, which is harder to facilitate online. And I think it will be a shame if we see this continuing, you know, and more bars and clubs closing down and everything shifting into an online space.
Yeah,
I don't think that's going to happen yet. We're all still going to want to party. We're all still going to want to drink.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's how far this goes, really.
Yeah. Well, we've got to get to a song for a little bit, but that's something we should touch on later, is a sense of connection and how it plays into drug use and our relationship with it. So you're listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is Well, 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 and you're listening to Joy 94.9. We're continuing the conversation with Adam Bourne, and we want to talk a little bit more about chemsex. So earlier we mentioned chemsex. I guess this could be described as having sex whilst taking drugs or on chems. And there's been a lot of talk about this lately with the chemsex documentary and the gay press talking about it. So why is this something that we need to know about?
Chemsex is a significant problem, but probably for a very small number of people. It is an issue which has exploded in terms of media coverage
in the UK,
and I think the same is true in Australia as well, from what I've seen.
Yeah.
I mean, every major newspaper has run a story about chemsex in the UK over the last 18 months. There have been comments about it in the House of Commons, in our Parliament. Our Secretary of State for Health has made statements about it. Everyone is very, very animated about this as a topic. And it's kind of easy to see why. It's a combination of sex and drugs. It can come across as quite dark and sinister. I think the word itself almost sounds racy and sounds exciting. Now, it is a serious problem in that some of the men engaging in chemsex are finding themselves in some quite difficult situations. They're struggling to manage their drug use. They're struggling to negotiate sex safely. But they are quite a minority of men of gay and bisexual men. Not all gay men use drugs. Not all gay men who do use drugs use them in a sexual context. And even those who don't necessarily have a problem with it. What we have to be mindful of is those people who have developed a dependency on drugs during sex. They're struggling to have sex without drugs anymore. They're struggling to have sober sex. They're struggling to manage their use in a way that enables them to still effectively negotiate condom use with a sexual partner, or to be able to talk about their HIV status or their partner's HIV status so that they're ensuring that they're both, you know, they're both either positive or they're both either negative. And sometimes they're so kind of off their heads, they've taken so many drugs, they're not able to have that kind of reasoned conversation with a sexual partner. It's in those circumstances that chemsex is worrying and that we need to be attentive to. But we have to be careful not to sensationalize it. This is an issue affecting a small number of people.
Yeah. Is there anything that you could point out that would be a general motivator for people to have chemsex?
I think there are two, really. So one is guys using drugs to try to overcome problems that they have. Right. So maybe they have a low, they don't feel great about their body, they mm-hmm. have very low self-esteem, they're not very confident about their sex that they have. Mm. And or they're positive and they're worried about rejection from a sexual partner, and you take some drugs, it really distances you from those kinds of feelings.
Yeah.
And you can escape from those worries and concerns. So that's kind of one main motivator, I think. The other is because they can really enhance sex. They can make sex feel much more intense, much more pleasurable. They can allow you to have sex for a longer period of time. You can achieve, if you can dose your drugs carefully to reach at the same point, you can sex can feel very, you can feel very sexually connected to a sexual mm. partner as well. And we have to be honest about that. Like, I mean, drugs and alcohol serve a purpose, that we wouldn't use them as a population unless they had positive outcomes as well.
Yeah.
And so we have to be honest that those things exist.
Yeah. And that it feels good.
And that it feels good. Absolutely.
Yeah. How much do you think this is peer pressured or a community norm that plays into that?
How do you mean? Sorry.
Sort of like chemsex, if it's kind of like normalized, or it's like, oh, well, my community's doing it. How much do you think that's actually an issue?
I think for us, it's still not a norm.
Yeah.
I mean, people are aware of it increasingly, partly because of a lot of the media attention that's been brought to bear on it. And people are aware that drug use, I would say drug use generally, is more of a social norm among gay men.
Yeah.
Mm. It's understood that we all use drugs a fair amount, probably more than our heterosexual brothers and sisters. And that I would say has, you know, there's probably evidence to show that it is normative within our communities.
Yeah.
Chemsex hasn't reached that point yet. Mm-hmm. It's still mm-hmm. a little bit dark. It's a little, say, it's a little bit sinister in the way it's kind of talked about among the community generally.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, if you're someone engaging in chemsex, then you'll have a very, very different view of it, understandably.
Well, yeah. What's interesting about that is we look at one of the reasons people talk about it like it's the sinister, scary thing is the risk that they assume is associated in terms of HIV transmission, STIs, other things like that. What is the actual risk of these things when it comes to chemsex?
Well, it really depends what, you know, what you're doing and how you're doing it. There's no sure and fast rule here. Mm. Some guys who use chems during sex are able to negotiate drugs and negotiate safe sex very, very well. Mm. And they continue to use condoms, or they continue to a zero sort to identify partners who have the same status as them, or they're using PrEP, or they're ensuring their partner has an undetectable viral load, and they're doing mm. it well. Some people are, like I said, find it very hard. They don't have the kind of cognitive capacity because they've taken so many drugs. Mm. They're not aware of what they're doing. They don't remember whether or not they used the condom. They don't remember if they asked the partner whether or not they were using, whether or not they had the same HIV status as them. Mm. And it's that kind of situation that's most concerning.
And another thing is also when you are on drugs, you can actually have sex for longer periods of time, isn't mm. it? So physically, you might not feel like any pain if you had tears, or like just in terms of the length of time that you're having sex, that can obviously kind of cause abrasions on the skin or anything mm. like that mm. that contributes,
yeah,
isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yeah. And so that's something we did observe in some research we've done before is penile abrasion. So it's cuts mm-hmm. or tears, or cuts or sores on your penis, or rectal fissures, which mm. have a small little tears inside your bottom.
Yeah.
If you're a guy who's having sex and you are a bottom and you're having sex for a long period of time with quite a number of different guys, then there's a very real chance mm-hmm. that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that, if you have those kinds of tears, it leaves you much more susceptible to HIV and to other STIs.
Too much to talk about. We have to take a short little break, but we'll be right back. You're back with Well, 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 and we're talking with Dr. Adam Bourne about drug and alcohol use in the LGBTI community. Now, we've been talking about this a bit over the break, but Adam, some of the only stories we ever hear about, well, even here, but in the press, are the very sensational and shocking stories. How accurate are these, and how often how frequent are they, I guess?
How frequent are the shocking stories?
Yes.
Well, pretty frequent.
Well, I guess how accurate are they in terms of, do they reflect what's actually happening in the population?
No, not really, no. I mean, in the UK, we've had some truly some truly shocking reports that, you know, do suggest that all gay men are using drugs all of the time, and we spend all of our days and all of our weekends in crystal meth-fueled sex binges. And I'm sure there are some, you know, 50-year-old housewives in Middle England who listen and read the Daily Mail and actually believe that that is the reality for gay and bisexual men. But I'm afraid it's not quite the truth.
It's good to know.
It is a powerful thing, isn't it?
It is, yes.
They can be so sinister about it.
But it kind of gets to the point. There are those shocking stories, and so they do happen, albeit infrequently. But it gets to a point we were talking about earlier, is managing use versus problematic use. What's the distinction there, and how do we identify it?
It's identified by each person individually. Mm. Some guys will feel very comfortable and very in control using ice on 2 or 3, 4 days a week. They feel able to use to take a measured controlled dose. They know exactly how it's going to affect them, and they can deal with the consequences of a come down afterwards. Some people might only be able to manage one dose a week or one dose a month. And they might feel that any more than that they were getting out of control, and that was having a detrimental impact on their life. So it's not very easy to say a sure and fast rule of this amount is manageable and this amount isn't. All of drug use management is kind of very person-centered. People can deal with drugs in different ways, and so that's the kind of key thing to understand here.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any different with regards to just kind of drug use in general that you might have mentioned earlier. Would you be able to point out any particular predictors for problematic use or addiction? But, I mean, you might have gone through that earlier.
A question which I think people often find quite challenging is when they are asked the last time that they had sober sex. When you're forced to say, oh, actually, you know what, it was quite a long time since I last had sex without using drugs, or even when I was last sober and I hadn't been using alcohol. And that is a question which has been quite successful in back home in helping people to understand, maybe this is more of an issue than I felt it would be.
Yeah.
In terms of predictors, you know, it's really, really hard to say. Because chemsex is an issue, is something that affects older men and younger men, men who are richer and men who are poorer, men who are black and white and everything in between. It's really hard to point to specific things that mean it's more or less likely. The one thing I guess I can say is that a problematic relationship with chemsex, guys who are finding it very, very difficult to manage the use, it tends to be those who have more recently introduced to drugs. Mm-hmm. People who started taking cannabis when they were 15, they moved on to a whole range of other drugs, and ice or GHB are just the latest in a long line of drugs that they've taken. Those guys are a little bit more sorted, usually. They understand what they're doing.
It's in terms of experience.
Exactly, it's experience. Yeah. They understand how to protect themselves and manage their use. It's those ones who were introduced to it by a sexual partner 6 months ago. They've never used drugs before. They're not familiar with which drugs work well with other drugs, which ones will make you feel really bad if you use it with alcohol. It's those ones who more often tend them to find themselves kind of spiraling a bit.
Yeah, would you say that chemsex is a lot more common amongst gay men than lesbian women? And is there much research out there about it?
I would say yes, it is more common, but I would caveat that with we don't really know for sure because we haven't asked the question. We haven't collected much data about chemsex among lesbian and bisexual women, so that's not to say it doesn't happen, but for the minute we're not asking the right questions to say with any certainty, and that's a problem. That's something that people like me who work in research need to be addressing.
Does that same hold true for trans people? Because we mentioned earlier they have significantly higher rates even than gay and lesbian people.
Yeah, I mean absolutely. I think We know in every study that has been conducted anywhere in the world, trans people tend to have higher rates of drug use than anyone else. And, you know, you see that reflected time and, you know, time and time again. But that is a very small number of studies that have ever been conducted. I'm a little ashamed to say there's a great deal more for us to that we haven't there's a great deal we haven't done in understanding drug use practices among trans people, and there's a great deal more we need to do.
Yeah. I think all of us working in the sector are slowly trying to move towards that as well when it comes to research amongst trans men, trans women, and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I've got to take a short break.
Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Well, Well, Well. See what I did there? Mm-hmm. On Joy 94.9, we are still talking about drug and alcohol use in the LGBTI community. There's something that the way we've been talking about drugs, I would have in the past found quite challenging, and I imagine a number of people listening might find challenging, in that we treat it as quite, maybe not normal, but as not harmful in itself, as not this evil, insidious thing. Why aren't we treating it like that? Why aren't we telling people avoid drugs? Just say no, abstain, stay away from them.
The simplest answer to that, John, is that it's not particularly effective. Globally, we spend billions of dollars on programs trying to stop people from using drugs, and they have been very rarely been successful. Humanity is a species of people. We have used drugs for thousands, literally thousands of years. There's documented evidence of humans using drugs for a very, very, very long period of time. It is ingrained within our social structures. And we already often use drugs on a daily basis. Many of us will drink alcohol and we will use caffeine. These are drugs as well. Mm-hmm. These are just drugs that are a little bit more socially acceptable than other ones. So the simplest answer for why we don't, you know, advocate abstinence and don't use drugs is because we've learned that it's not a particularly effective strategy. It's much better to try to support people to use drugs safely and carefully if they choose to do so.
And vilifying the drugs and this whole war on drugs doesn't really work and can actually have quite detrimental effects, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, so there is a lot of talk about harm reduction and what it means for drug use. Can you explain to us what harm reduction is?
Yeah, so in the context of drug use, it can mean a whole range of things. So take, for example, something like injection drug use. So say you're someone who uses drugs and you choose to say you use ice and you choose to inject it. Then harm reduction is about, well, okay, do you have access to a clean needle? Do you know how to mix the drug appropriately and safely? Do you know how to inject yourself safely so that you don't cause damage to your veins or cause infections where at the site at which you're injecting yourself? Do you know how to dispose of your needle safely? If it's a drug, we have a big problem with a drug called GHB, which I know is one that does feature here in Australia, but not to the same extent. So harm reduction around G would be helping people to understand which drugs you can safely use G with and which you can't. G can be quite dangerous if you use it with alcohol, so it's educating people not to use it with alcohol. It's also educating people about, you know, how you can dose effectively. If you take too much G, you can go into what's called a G sleep. It's a state of unconsciousness. You pass out, essentially. Yeah. It's very, very easy to do. And so it's educating people around using the right amount of it if you're going to. And then some organizations will provide people with very miniature little pipettes, very, very tiny vials that help them to draw up the right amount of fluid, not too much, so that they reduce the chance that they overdose, they reduce the chance they pass out, they require hospitalization, or in fact reduce the fact that they overdose and die, which is a significant concern around that particular drug.
I know it can be a challenge to get people to even look into these strategies or take them up. Is this because of stigma, or what impact does stigma have on people and their willingness to reduce the harms associated?
Stigma has a negative impact on pretty much everything you can imagine about behavior.
You mean it's not a good thing?
It's not a good thing. The main reason really is that if you stigmatize a behavior, if you make people feel that something they're doing is shameful, then they're much less likely to go to access services to help them. They're much less likely to talk about it with their doctor, to go to a sexual health service, to go to a drug service, because they feel that what it is that they're doing is shameful and is stigmatized. They're also much less likely to talk about it with their friends or with their family, and to be honest about what it is they're doing and access that kind of social support, because they worry about what people will think of them if they're someone who's using drugs.
Yeah. Well, we have very, very, very rapidly run out of time, and I'm very disappointed in that. But, Dr. Adam Bourne, this has been really wonderful having you here tonight. We're so thankful you've come all this way, and we wish you the best of luck at your keynote speech at the conference next week. Next week?
Next week.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
It has been a very great pleasure, John and Jesse. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Well, if you've loved listening to Adam as much as we have, you have another opportunity. If you come to Hares and Hyenas at 63 Johnston Street, Fitzroy, tomorrow night at 7 p.m., Adam will be there speaking on many of these very same topics, albeit in a more raucous and accessible format, with a few members of the community. Again, come by Hares and Hyenas tomorrow at 7 p.m., and you can hear Adam talk more about this. In the meantime, thank you for listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. That is all our time for this week. A big thank you again to Adam Bourne, for joining us this evening. Jesse, we have some resources online that
we do. And if you wanted to find out more about how to manage drug use or need resources for mental health or sexual health, go online and check out Touchbase. It's an online resource specifically for LGBTI people who want information or advice regarding alcohol, drugs, and your health and well-being. And that website is www.touchbase.org.au.
Now, before we say goodnight, I do want to remind you of a couple important dates coming up, or rather, one important date coming up. Wednesday, the 26th of October, is Intersex Awareness Day, a day for all of us to raise our awareness and the awareness of others about the health and human rights issues that intersex people experience every day. It's a part of the LGBTI acronym that often goes unnoticed, and their needs very often unaddressed. So, to find out more about what it means to be intersex and how you can support the community, visit the website for OII Australia, Australia's peak intersex organization. Their web address is oii.org.au.
oii.org.au. That's cute. Well, thanks so much for joining us, everyone. Have an absolutely lovely evening. John, it's been a pleasure.
And you as well, Jesse. Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.